The reason I gave you the two sutras is because I wanted to give you a firsthand experience, and I encourage you, those who have not done it yet, to do that sometime when you have free time, that the teachings have always undergone interpretation. We do not know what the Buddha actually said. We know approximately. There are versions of what he said and what he intended. And then from the Pali, or from the Gandhari, or from the Telugu, or from the Sanskrit, there have been many, many different interpretations. And then into Chinese. For example, my teacher, who was a monk in both Japan and in China, very much felt that Chinese often misunderstood the sutras, and in the translation, Sinicized them and created a hybrid form of what he would call Chinese Buddhism, or almost a Chinese version according to Chinese aesthetics. Now, that may have happened as well in Tibet. It may have happened in every country. It may have happened when we translate the Buddha teachings into English. I myself have known several Sri Lankan monks who have done translations, and each one has interpreted the words, the Pali words, differently, despite having very, very similar educational foundations. So the first thing we have to understand, and by now you should all be getting used to my emphasis on practicality and about your own process and realization, that ultimately you are your teacher. This returns us a little bit to the question that Mariam asked last week, what about a mentor? A mentor can assist you in sharing what their experience was, like this is what these discourses are about. I'm not teaching you this is the right Buddhism. This is the Dharma as I have experienced and practiced it, and even through my life it has changed and transformed itself. But the tools which each one of us must acquire to verify, validate, and use in our life to determine what it is for us is what a mentor can help a student accomplish, realize, and then use for themselves. The tools, once you have them as skills, are yours, and the results will be yours. They won't be a copy of your teachers or your guides or your mentors or whoever that person is, but there will be similarities. That's one reason you find the mentor that you find. There were great similarities in personality between myself and my teacher. And it's very odd because we were very different characters from very different backgrounds. But that's one way we were able to work together. And ultimately, I think that's why people are able to work together. So whenever we study any kind of text or any kind of teaching, and I'll now broaden that to mean wisdom teaching, we have to understand, what language was this written? When was it written? What was the context? And who has presented it to us? Meaning, what has it gone through before it's got to us? And this is a little bit of what I want to speak about in our pre-textual discussion today. What is pursuing wisdom? That's a question for you. Anybody want to answer? What is pursuing wisdom? Why do we pursue it? What benefits will it bring? Over to you. Anyone?
Lightness of living?
Lightness of living?
Mm.
What do you mean by light?
Light. No angst. Very little angst. A little angst.
Freedom of angst. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. That's one reason to pursue wisdom.
Personal knowledge, and I guess if you pursue wisdom is because you feel that there's something that you don't know, or you want to know, or you want to fulfill. So a personal, let's call it, hunger for knowledge.
What are you hoping it will bring you?
Peace of mind.
So we're back to lightness of living. That's another way of saying lightness of living. Okay. Anybody else? There's no right answer, by the way.
No,
I don't think so.
Understanding.
I'm with Johnny on the lightness of living.
Lightness of living, okay.
And being able to just manage everything. And you know, our lives are so chaotic today, and we're thrown so many curveballs that it's nice to be able to sometimes not react.
Okay.
Okay. For me, I just think it's I'm just a person who just collect books and just reading knowledge of different variety of books, and I learn and I see things, expand my mind, and I like it when it changed me, when I see something that I didn't see, recognize it before, and I see it different way, and I like that. And it just, when it changed me, it make me more acceptance. I like that. I don't like when I looked down, not looked down, judge maybe, at anything or anyone. So it gives me a balance of who I am. And I'm in pursuit of that constantly.
Okay. So again, we're back to similar to lightness of living, peace, harmony, something that'll help us be who we are and learn to live more easily, maybe more in the present is what the jargon would say, right?
Yeah.
I'm glad none of you said live more in the present, because that's so jargonish today. Okay. Anybody else? Okay. So what do you think is the relationship between wisdom and philosophy? Now, think carefully, because you may be defining, I'm going to give you a little bit of a hint here, but I know I can come from left field sometimes. You may be defining philosophy by a very limited definition that you have in your head. So what do you think is the relationship between wisdom and philosophy?
One comes from the other.
Ah, that's very good. They're related. Okay. Which one do you think comes from the other?
I think it's a vice versa thing. I mean, if you have philosophy, you get to wisdom. And if you have wisdom, you understand philosophy. It's like the faces of a coin, or the same coin for me.
Okay.
Wisdom and philosophy.
That's good. Anybody else? Nobody else.
I would agree with that.
You'd agree with what Tatiana said. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Mash, you were gonna say something?
I guess it could look both ways at it, the way Tatiana said, but also that the wisdom can occur also without necessarily studying it as a subject, or as a, conscious pursuit. I mean, things occur in life and you can't always predict the way it's gonna happen. So one day somebody wakes up and boom, he has a insight or a realization of something.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Wisdom is the application of philosophy somehow. Okay. It goes from your mind to the way you live, to your where you are.
Okay.
It's a digested philosophy.
Oh, I like that, digested philosophy. I like that one.
Yeah, I would also say I agree with that one. For me, it was very much about the connection between the two. And personally, I found that if I only stay within the domain of reading intellectually about philosophy, and yet I haven't applied it in any form of living, doesn't really quite work that way. So.
Yeah, very good, very good. Okay, that's great.
Yes, it's just because you understand something doesn't mean you really truly living or applying it.
Okay.
You just know the meaning, but you don't actually have the wisdom.
Okay, very good. So, would we consider the Buddha Dharma a philosophy? I got you all, didn't I?
It's a way of living.
Okay.
It is a philosophy. It's a way of living, and it's a philosophy.
Okay.
Of living. You say philosophy of living most of the time.
Okay.
My philosophy, so it's my way of living as well.
Okay. So, do you think that most professional philosophers, meaning people in the universities that teach philosophy, actually live their philosophy?
No.
Isn't that interesting?
Very rarely.
Now we've come to a very interesting thing.
They may teach it, but they are probably not living it.
Uh-huh. So would a person who teaches philosophy and has studied it their whole life but is not living it be considered a wise person? Could they be a wise person?
No, just a person with a lot of knowledge on the subject.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we have here a very interesting relationship. That philosophy and wisdom perhaps we could say wisdom is the result of a person living philosophy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, not everybody's philosophy is the same. But as long as a person is living their philosophy, that they believe in themselves, who they are, then they'll gain a wisdom about what?
Nature what? Of
huh?
Themselves.
Ah, they would gain wisdom about themselves, wouldn't they? Because each one of you is your teacher. You choose to live a life. You decide on a philosophy that's appropriate for yourself. You live it, and you gain knowledge and wisdom about yourself. Once you gain knowledge and wisdom about yourself, well, isn't that interesting? Because in the Buddha Dharma, we don't have a self, do we? So what are you gaining knowledge of?
Reality.
Okay, it's a possibility, reality. What else? That was a little bit of a trick I threw in there, a monkey wrench, I know, because it's not so simple, but I thought it was a good challenge for you to consider. Let's go back. Let's say we're not using the Buddha Dharma as criteria. Let's say there's a self, we'll call it a self for now, and you gain knowledge about yourself. You practice your own philosophy that you believe, you become wise about yourself. What happens once you become wise about yourself? What happens almost automatically without even wanting it once you become wise about yourself? And wise about yourself, I would throw in the interpretation that Socrates always said, the first thing is know yourself, who you are before all else, above all else. That was on the doorpost of his academy, know yourself. So what would happen once you're wise about yourself through the practice of your philosophy that you've arrived at? What would necessarily start to happen?
You start sharing it.
You might want to share it.
Mm-hmm. We just become a better person in a way that you accept other people and you relate to other people with more.
What would make you become a better person?
Understanding others, understanding oneself, therefore understanding other people's sufferings, imperfections, whatever.
Yeah, but what if a person is a very self-centered, self-absorbed individual and they become more of themselves and they become wise about themselves and their philosophy, would they become a better self also? Or would they become an autocrat?
Yeah.
As we see every day on the news these days.
Give them a chance.
It's an interesting question, isn't it?
Very.
Yeah, it is.
So if you become wise about yourself and you start to know yourself, there is the possibility that will lead you to understanding reality, as Mosh said earlier, that you function in, because you have to function in that way. And reality is reflexive. The macrocosm and the microcosm are reflexive. We don't exist in a vacuum, as we learned last week with the Paticca Samuppada. We're all dependent and related to each other, and codependent, interdependent. Therefore, knowledge of true knowledge and wisdom of oneself will eventually lead to understanding of all the factors that contribute to oneself, right?
Right.
So let's take this now a little bit back in the direction of the discourse. We go over suttas here and we review Anapanasati and Satipatthana and mindfulness and the jhanas and the Paticca-samuppada, and you absorb them to certain degrees that you do and you feel comfortable with them and you're all excited about practicing them and the breathing, etc. Are you developing a philosophy for yourself, or are you becoming an adherent to another philosophy?
Well, for myself, basically. Yeah.
What would we say, a person who says, well, I'm adhering to this other philosophy, so because that's who, I'm a devotee of that.
Good, if it helps you, why not?
Are they learning more about themselves?
Possibly, possibly not.
Mm-hmm.
If they tap into it, yes, otherwise, no. You just listen to things that they don't make sense to you.
Okay, so let's go back to philosophy and wisdom. Let me ask you another question. What is one of the key differences between Eastern and Western philosophical traditions, and in fact, between religions and Western philosophical traditions as well? So we have Western philosophical traditions over here, and on this side, we have Eastern philosophical traditions and religions. What's one of the key differences between them? What can you think of?
Doubt.
Doubt.
Eastern philosophies allow for doubt.
But religions don't allow for doubt.
True. That's why I'm not religious.
But they're sharing this quality that I'm looking for, this difference. It's putting Western philosophy all the way over in a corner by itself.
One is more practical than the other, I guess.
Okay. The religions and Eastern philosophies have held on to a practice, right?
Yeah.
If you are a Taoist or a Buddhist or a Hindu or a shamanic religion, or you're an Orthodox Jew or Orthodox Christian, Orthodox Muslim, or any of the derivatives thereof, you are given something to do, right? You have breathing, you have yoga, you have dietary requirements, you have clothing requirements, you're governed in certain ways of speaking, right? Certain ethical structure. We talked in the Dharma, we have Panchasila, right? The virtues, the five basic virtues. So these are fundamentally provided practices and guidelines from one bunch over here. But this other bunch of Western traditions, philosophy, where it has great philosophy, those of Socrates, those of Plato, I'm very partial to pre-Socratic, but the Stoics are post-Socratic, or Plotinus, Neoplatonic. All of these have some very interesting things, but why don't they have any practices? Have you ever thought about that? So I'm going to offer to you something. It's because they did not hold on to the practices that they actually had. So there were practices. Socrates had a practice, Socratic dialogue, questioning, reflection. The Stoics have a practice to determine what's within your sphere of influence, what's outside your sphere of influence. The Neoplatonists, they had a practice of mystical union. But something happened in the evolution of the classics and into Western society that was left behind. And that separation then became, as we know it in our universities and in modern universities around the world, philosophy, separate from wisdom. Because without the practices, all the ancient classical teachers of ancient Greece and Rome and the Near East that are part of that said very clearly, you will not arrive at the wisdom of happiness or knowing yourself. In order to know yourself, you must have a practice, a daily practice. And there's a very, very famous Western philosopher who I was just introduced to recently, who I was very happily introduced to recently, he's dead now, named Pierre Hadot, H-A-D-O-T, who spent his whole life on that principle that the philosophers of classical antiquity, and by those I mean the Greek, Roman, etc., had practices that their students were required to do. And if they didn't do them, they would never be able to obtain the benefits of the philosophy they were teaching.